Hey, I'm Troy Thomas, and welcome to the Liberty and Slavery podcast, where we take a look back at some of the interviews that we recorded when we were making our Emmy Award-winning documentary, Liberty and Slavery, The Paradox of America's Founding Fathers. We traveled the country to interview scholars, authors, theologians, and historians, all to discuss America's founding era and its long-lasting influence on each of us today. In fact, understanding America's history may be more important today than at any time in American history. On today's podcast, we welcome Carter Hudgens. Carter is the president and CEO of Drayton Hall Preservation and Trust. He was formerly a staff archaeologist at historic Jamestown. This interview was conducted in Charleston, South Carolina in March 2014. Carter, a real pleasure to sit down with you here at Drayton Hall today and talk about Drayton Hall, the plantation in particular. But I know that what you have going on here at Drayton Hall is a little bit different than the plantation systems that you see in my home state of Virginia. So maybe can you explain the difference of Drayton Hall compared to some of the other plantations of the colonial period and of the founding fathers?
When Drayton Hall was conceived in 1738, it was conceived to be the home seat, the management center of John Drayton's plantation empire. And that empire was really a network of upwards of 145 properties. Some were plantations, some were urban residences, but the total of acreage was 76,000 acres. And that is the commercial base for Drayton Hall. Plantations were scattered all across South Carolina and Georgia, from as little as 100 acres up to 20,000 acres in size. But what was going on these plantations was the raising of cattle and pigs, livestock that was being raised, butchered, salted, and shipped to the Caribbean, where that material, the beef, if you will, was being used to support the slaves that were growing the sugar in the Caribbean. And then rice and indigo were also cultivated on these plantations for exportation to Europe and other cities in North America.
So that's interesting. What you're saying is that the food that was being grown here on the plantation at Drayton Hall was really the food that was being eaten by the slaves in the Caribbean.
Right. And this is the staple commodities that were being produced on Drayton-owned plantations were supporting the workforce, the slaves, if you will, that were growing the sugar in the Caribbean.
So, Carter, looking at the big picture here, I mean, slavery really was the main thing that drove the economy in the American South, if I understand what you're saying.
Slave labor was the machine that produced the wealth coming out of the American South. Without slavery, the commodities would not have been produced, and the level of wealth, opulence, and conspicuous consumption that we see at plantations like Drayton Hall would not have been the same.
You know, we did an interview with David Eltis at Emory University, and he was talking about that a lot of the crops that were being grown in the Caribbean and elsewhere, that they were really things that were not really even that important. They were luxury items, in other words, things like sugar and coffee and things that you could live without. So we had all of this slave labor going into things that were really luxury items.
Absolutely. The sugar that's being grown on the Caribbean, as well as other commodities in South America, such as coffee, they were luxury commodities. And it is ironic that the slave labor in South Carolina that's producing staple commodities, beef, rice to support that slave-based agriculture were producing luxury goods that Europeans and American colonists could have easily survived without.
That's a great point. So I want to talk about Drayton Hall in particular, because you have this paradox going on right here on this plantation between the freedom of John Drayton or Charles Drayton, and at the same token, right beside them, you have people that are enslaved. And some people have used the analogy of the slaves are like prisoners in a prison. And of course, John and Charles Drayton are the people experiencing the freedom. So maybe talk a little bit about that paradox and the different classes of slaves.
Yeah, I personally don't like the prison analogy. Okay. For me, the analogy of a prison, it's four walls that you're never going to get out of. And that was certainly the case at some plantations. Even being an enslaved person in an urban environment, there certainly were occasions where you had four walls. At places like Drayton Hall, and I'm not trying to whitewash this whatsoever because it was a terrible situation, at Drayton Hall, there are clearly different classes of enslaved people. Don't know which would have been better or worse, but you have domestic slaves, those that are working in the house. And being a domestic servant may have been the most challenging of any of the labels because they were always operating under the watchful eye of their owner, always in close contact. A second category would be slaves that were working in the fields. So enslaved laborers working on the 76,000 acres. A third category are skilled slaves. And John Drayton certainly owned skilled slaves, masons, carpenters, blacksmiths. They were not practicing those trades here strictly on the plantation. They were being leased out to other construction projects oftentimes. And so when you think about both field slaves and skilled slaves that were moving between plantations, either to carry out a trade, a blacksmith, a carpenter, or even field slaves moving from plantation to harvest crops, depending on what season it was, they are not operating within a physical prison. And I think by understanding that degree of mobility, which is oftentimes not acknowledged within slave studies and the general American perception of slavery, that degree of mobility opened up a market economy. It opened up social relationships. And I think it's that dynamic relationship with slaves and their landscapes and slaves and other communities that we really need to increase our understanding of.
Carter, I know that the Port of Charleston was very busy with slaves. So maybe can you talk a little bit about Charleston and the port and how many slaves would have come through that port and been dispersed to other parts of the country?
So during the 18th century, an incredible number of enslaved Africans came through the Port of Charleston. And as many as potentially 40% of all enslaved people that came to the colonies came through the Port of Charleston. Charleston was the wealthiest port city in British North America in the time. Slaves coming in to the harbor were not only employed in the immediate Lowcountry lands, but dispersed throughout the colonies as well to produce those commodities that Europeans desired, the rice, the indigo, as well as the cattle and pigs for exportation to the Caribbean.
So, Carter, I know you're an archaeologist. What can you tell me about the archaeological record here at Drayton Hall? I mean, what does it show us?
At Drayton Hall, we have both documented and physical evidence of people of African descent being enslaved alongside of people of Native American descent. The documentary record clearly illustrates how Native Americans were enslaved at Drayton Hall, and it's particularly the case with the raising of livestock. Native Americans are listed as cattle hunters and located on several of the Drayton family plantations. Many acres of open fields, woods for the livestock to live, and the cattle hunters did their job keeping those animals within an enclosed area. Archaeological excavations have been carried out at Drayton Hall since the mid-1970s. And in the course of those excavations, an incredible range of material culture has been excavated, not only that represents the material culture of the Drayton family, but also the enslaved people that lived and worked here. So many, many boxes of colonyware, a low-fired earthenware ceramic produced, if not on the property, in the adjacent area, has been excavated. And colonyware is incredibly interesting because it's produced very similar to how you would produce a pot in art class. You roll a coil, you wind it, you smooth the outsides, you burnish those, and then it's fired almost in a campfire. When you have folks of various cultural backgrounds working together, you have a fusion of cultural traditions, and that's clearly illustrated in the Kalanoware, where you have ceramic vessel forms that are both representative of African and Native American vessel forms and decorative techniques put together.
So is there any way to arrive at a percentage of what percent of the slaves would have been African American versus Native American?
In terms of looking at the ratio of enslaved African versus Native American peoples, it's clear that most of the enslaved Native Americans are working in John Drayton's commercial plantations, where particularly where cattle and pigs were raised for exportation to the Caribbean. So referenced often as Native cattle hunters, these Native American people were in charge for managing livestock in John Drayton's outlying plantations. As it applies to the Drayton home seat, there is no written description of a race or a culture of people that are working here. Presumably, as you move through the 18th century, there's a greater ratio of enslaved people of African descent, and this is represented in the archaeological collection. A lot of the material culture that's been excavated and associated with Drayton Hall's early years, you do see a fusion of Native and African potting techniques shows up in the ceramics. As you move closer to the American Revolution, the percentage of Native American ceramic types decreases in favor for a huge increase in African-made pots.
So there are Africans that are making pottery here that they would have made in Africa. So they're carrying the tradition from Africa to North America.
Right. To think, if you were an enslaved person, what could you bring to the New World? You were not allowed to bring any of your domestic material culture, if you will. And so really what was brought to the New World, and this shows up in a significant way in pottery, is that knowledge was brought, cultural knowledge, cultural traditions were brought to the New World. And to take something like Kalanoware, a low-fired earthenware ceramic, that really holds the potting tradition, the cultural and technological traditions that were at play in Africa, transferred to the New World in order to produce these pots.
Talk to me a little bit about how skilled some of these slaves were, because I think most people's concept is that they're out picking cotton and they don't really know what they're doing. But that's not really true, is it? I mean, these people were quite skilled with rice and with the different types of crops that they were doing, right?
Right. The skill, the knowledge base of enslaved people, I think is something that is grossly misunderstood. You had here at Drayton Hall, there were several categories of enslaved people, or I should say, within the Drayton plantation network, there were different categories of enslaved people. And each of those categories carried with them their own knowledge base. And so you had within the domestic sphere, those folks working within the house had to know how to cook, how to clean, how to navigate political encounters with the landowners. Those folks working in the field had to know how to cultivate rice, which is a very manual endeavor. But thinking about how rice was produced, flooding of fields, timing of tides, that all required a knowledge and an understanding of the landscape and weather patterns to be able to produce. By and large, the most skilled category of slaves within the Drayton network were those skilled carpenters, masons, and blacksmiths. And these individuals were leased to neighboring plantations, to construction projects occurring in downtown Charleston. And they had a knowledge of ironworking, carpentry, masonry.
I mean, stepping back to give us a larger view, I mean, one guy that we had interviewed at the Freedom Center up in Cincinnati said that America really was built on the backs of slaves. And I guess my question would be, is that an accurate statement? In other words, would America have grown as fast as it did without the economy of the slaves, slave labor, if you will? Or, I mean, put that in any context you want. I guess my real question is, how important was slave economy?
I think echoing that, really the only thing that you could say is, yes, absolutely, slave labor is essential to what was being produced in the American colonies at the time. Without slave labor, the economy falls. It's almost like gasoline. If we lost gasoline as a fuel today, would our economy stop? Absolutely. And that's a very similar thing to the role that enslaved labor played in the American colonies.
Carter, it seems like here at Drayton Hall, like most of the places we've been, it seems like there is a consensus or a conscious effort to embrace both sides of the equation, liberty and slavery. In other words, in the case of John Drayton and Charles Drayton and their descendants, that they were these people, great people of liberty, and they were living the American dream, but at the same time, they were slave owners. So it seems like you guys here at Drayton Hall are making a conscious effort to embrace both sides of these men. Is that accurate?
One significant thing to keep in mind is that enslaved people were either captured or born into this system of enslaved labor. On the other side of that, the slave owners oftentimes were born into the system. They had a very different role, but that was their understanding. That was their upbringing. That was what they were born into from a child. This system of wealth, of power, of status, of social stratification. And it's oftentimes very difficult for us to think about that paradox of freedom and slavery, to wrap our heads around the fact that for the white slave owner, that's what they were born into. That was the cultural and political system and all that they knew. And could explain why it took so long to reach abolition and change the system.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of it quite that way, in that the slave owners were born into slave owning just like the slaves were born into slavery.
To understand the system, these are not, you know, wealthy white individuals, mature individuals who are suddenly saying, oh, I'm going to become a slave owner. Most times they were born into the system. You know, us being born into democracy today, it's something that's kind of taken for granted. It's a way of life. And for these individuals, slavery being a central component to the way that they live their lives, it's the way that it's always been, and it's the way that it's going to be. And so to try to change that is a very difficult thing to do and takes several generations of slave owners and politicians to do so.
Carter, if you could just give us a brief soundbite about why it is that people came to the New World from England or from Europe.
The primary reason that individuals traveled from Europe, and particularly England, to the New World was all about economic gain. Sure, there was propaganda, there was literature noting religious freedom, but it was all about economics. People traveled with a desire to find resources that they could profit from and create a better life for themselves.
So, Carter, just in general, can you talk to me about slavery in this part of South Carolina and how prevalent slavery would have been during the colonial period?
Slavery was incredibly prevalent in this part of the colonies, coastal South Carolina, the Low Country. Commodities that were being produced, including rice and indigo, were incredibly labor sensitive, requiring an enormous amount of labor to produce the commodity. And so the byproduct of the production of rice and indigo and the labor that it required was a black majority. I can't remember exactly by what point, but in the years leading up to the American Revolution, there were more people of African descent living in the colony of South Carolina than there were of white, of European descent.
So the majority of the population in South Carolina would have been black.
The majority of South Carolina's plantation in the years leading up to the American Revolution was black. And that was because of the labor requirement for producing rice and indigo. As a side note, it's really interesting to think about the cattle production, because there are several instances of plantations of hundreds of acres, sometimes thousands of acres, thousands of head of cattle. How many slaves were working on these properties? Four, five, small handful. Those were the folks that were actually doing the management of the livestock. But you have to think about, there's a whole support group who are producing pottery or food or shelter for those enslaved people as well. So there's this entire system, I think, that we have yet to fully understand.
I feel like you've covered the subject pretty good. Is there anything else maybe that I haven't talked about that you feel is worth adding?
I think it's worth noting that John Drayton was the 1%. He was in a minority as far as landowners of this size. Sure, South Carolina in the 18th century, and particularly the years leading up to the American Revolution, there was a black majority, but there was a small number of white slave owners who owned the majority of slaves. So we do not have a total number of the slaves that John Drayton owned. Presumably it's in the hundreds, given the 76,000 acres of agricultural land that he managed. But as far as planters owning hundreds of slaves, they're very few and far between, and John Drayton's certainly one of those few. I think most people, planters, slave owners here in South Carolina, had a handful of slaves working a smaller quantity of acres for producing rice.
So, Carter, maybe you can clear this up for us, because I think there's this misconception that people have about colonial America that all white people had slaves. And, of course, that's not true. But sort of give us a percentage, or how many people would have had a slave. Like, your common white poor person wouldn't have had a slave. I mean, it would have only been for your wealthy that had large plantations that would have had several slaves, right? I mean, some people would have had one or two slaves, but sort of give us an overview of that.
To look at Drayton Hall as a home seat, it's a very rare and unique situation where you have a very wealthy landowner, very wealthy planter who owns potentially hundreds of slaves. But in comparison to the majority of planters in the South Carolina Lowcountry who owned one, two, maybe even five slaves working a handful of acres to produce rice for the European economy, Drayton Hall is very unique in terms of its size and its scope. The scale of such a production is very rare. Folks such as the Middletons, the Draytons, the Bulls had plantations of this size, particularly in the Ashley River region, but they're very rare. It's certainly not the case that every white person owned hundreds of slaves in South Carolina.
So just tell me a little bit about how the slavery cycle would have worked. I know you mentioned that rice would have gone to England, and you were talking about cattle going to the Caribbean. And maybe just give me an overview about how the slavery and the money worked and the crops. We're just looking for that cycle of how the whole thing really worked.
There are three primary commodities that are being produced in the colonial Lowcountry: rice, indigo, and livestock. And where each of those commodities traveled to ultimately is a pretty interesting story. Rice and indigo, more basic. The rice is grown here, the indigo is grown and processed in South Carolina, and then transported to Europe. Some rice, I believe, is also being transported to the Caribbean. The more dynamic process is the raising and exportation of cattle and pigs. To begin with, the cattle and the pigs are grown in the Lowcountry. Oftentimes, they're marched to downtown Charleston to the market, where they're slaughtered, they're butchered. That commodity, the meat, is ultimately sent to the Caribbean to sustain the population of slaves there being grown. But you think, before days of refrigeration. How do you transport slaughtered pigs and cattle down to the Caribbean? You need salt. The process of exporting cattle and pigs to the Caribbean really starts in two areas. Salt is being gathered in salt flats in the Caribbean. That's being sent to Charleston. At the same time, the cattle and the pigs are being reared before they're slaughtered, combined with the salt, and sent to the Caribbean to maintain the population of slaves on the Caribbean sugar islands.
Yeah, so the salt is being grown there and it's being shipped here, and then the salt's put on the cattle and it goes to the Caribbean. And so it kind of goes round and round. And so the rice is being sent to England. And what is England sending us?
So the trade, the exportation of rice, is being grown, it's being harvested, it's being processed in the Low Country. That's then being exported to England. Now, surely there is cash that is being exchanged between factors in London and planters in the Low Country. But you've got to think also about the commodities that England is shipping to the New World in a place like Charleston or Drayton Hall. The archaeological record really shows the quantity and the quality of goods that are being exported and being consumed by planters such as John Drayton. So it's cash, but then it's also fashionable material goods as well.
Carter, it's been a real pleasure to sit down with you here at Drayton Hall in South Carolina. It's a different kind of plantation than I'm used to seeing in Virginia. So really learned a lot. Thank you for explaining so much to us today.
For more information on the Emmy-winning documentary, Liberty and Slavery, The Paradox of America's Founding Fathers, or information on the Liberty and Slavery podcast, visit libertyandslavery.com. Thanks for listening.